It's the last evening of our retreat together. It seems very appropriate and perfect that this last evening in day tomorrow coincides with the Shabbat celebration. I felt very touched to be included in a part of that lovely observance and simple yet profound ceremony that happened this evening. Sitting there and being at ease with the sun as it was setting. The last moments of the day, lovely mellow light, reflecting on our faces, turning to dusk. And everyone gathering together in harmony with the setting of the sun, in harmony with this rhythm of once every 7 days to pause, come together, look beyond our views, our opinions, our feelings, look beyond our skin, our body, to pause, to stop, and reflect what is precious, what is sacred, what nourishes us, what supports us, what harms us. Something so simple, sitting in a circle, listening to lovely music, coming together in the listening, being attuned to the sound of creation, attuned to the feeling of the setting sun, attuned to that sense of, for a moment, forgetting our separateness and appreciating our togetherness, celebrating beauty of our voices, of our movement, of our capacity to appreciate our blessings, to light the candles. Something so simple and yet so beautiful. Yet we can get so complicated we can forget the simple beauties, simple blessings, simple treasures. So to me, these are just my thoughts. The essence of Shabbat, the essence of this rhythm, perhaps an ancient spirit of all this activity that maybe we do 6 days a week, can we give over one day to stopping and recollecting what have we set in motion? Recollect what has been done. To ponder and remember what do we most cherish, what is most important. Maybe we've forgotten. And in pausing and listening, just that much, pausing and listening to see, rather than trying to create something new, hurry, 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 to sense what has been done, what is here now. In that pausing and listening, we attune ourselves with something more profound, something deeper, something at the core, something at all of our cores. That's how we, why we can do it together, feel this kinship. In a sense, that's the spirit of a meditation retreat as well, to pause. So that we're eyeball to eyeball, as one of our teachers says, eyeball to eyeball with our karma. When we pause and are silent, giving our attention to acknowledging what is, and also to acknowledge what we've set in motion, our habits, our tendencies, which come up very strongly, as we know from these days together. Sometimes it's so strong that we can't sit still. Sometimes it's so strong it makes us want to run away. But something in us perhaps wants to know, what have I set in motion? What have I been creating? And by stopping and listening, we can sense whether it's skillful, whether it's something that, in retrospect, something that we approve of, something that we want to continue. It's lovely that we were celebrating the Shabbat. We've had a chance to talk some to each other, share some, and also to return to the silence for tonight and tomorrow morning, just for the sake again to see more clearly what tends to get created with our mind, with our speech, with our actions, when we make contact with one another, so that we can learn and get more of a sense what is beautiful, what is wholesome, what is good, what is for our welfare. When we learn to recognize that, we can feed that, celebrate that. Maybe we notice when we pause and stop some things which aren't so good. Hateful tendencies of mind, just blaming tendencies of mind, either against ourselves or someone else. Cramped, contracted, fearful mind. We might realize, that's something to be patient with, but to little by little let be, let go. Tomorrow also is the Buddhist Shabbat. Very important one. there is this principle, and I think I mentioned it earlier in the retreat, in the Buddhist tradition, once a week with the phases of the moon, one stops. It's called an observance day, a day of observing. Not only observing the body, mind, and how things are, but also observing, recollecting those teachings that we cherish, which we trust, guide us more and more toward truth, toward harmony, toward peace. Tomorrow is a very special one of those days. Tomorrow is the full moon of the month of Magga in the Buddhist calendar. And that, in the Buddhist calendar for at least Theravada countries, is the Sangha Day. It's the day 2,500 some odd years ago on a full moon night of Magga that 1,250 of the Buddha's enlightened disciples gathered together without an invitation. He didn't send out an invitation, let's come and see the Buddha tonight. But all 1,250 of this group all thought, let's go find where the Buddha is tonight. Meet him. Listen to him. They gathered on this night. And we remember it because on this particular occasion the Buddha gave some simple teachings which was laying out a path, a code of discipline, which is what harmonizes the Sangha. It's what allows groups of people to come in harmony when they agree on certain ways of being, even though they might have different preferences or different likes or different dislikes, and there's certain common commitments that helps them live in harmony. This proclamation of this particular teaching was called the Owada Padimokkha. The Padimokkha is that which leads one out of the wilderness. It leads one to freedom. What leads one out of the thicket of views and opinions? There's a few simple teachings. One was Kanti Paramang Tapo Tittika Nibbanang Paramang Vadanti Buddha. So you got that one down. You would think that this teaching, you know, it's not an introductory retreat. You know, 1,250 enlightened disciples, you figure, well, it's going to be way beyond us. It's going to be something way up there. Something very esoteric. But it's beautiful in its simplicity. Kanti paramang tapotitika means patient endurance is the ultimate practice for burning away that which those harmful states, those unskillful states. Nibbana is the ultimate happiness. Patient endurance. Patiently. We see something that we don't like in ourselves, maybe anger. We see something we don't like, greed. We see something we don't like, fear. It's not a question of just crushing it out, pushing it away. But patiently, learning to see it, learning to recognize it, learning to let it be so that it comes and goes and it doesn't ruffle the heart, doesn't disturb us. If we think freedom is just not seeing these things anymore, we create a lot of trouble. Then we can start pushing things away and thinking we're free. Then the the slightest ripple of it coming up, and then we go, oh, there it is again. God. See, the meditation doesn't work. I knew it. Oh. It means the slightest thought, the slightest worry, the slightest appearance of something comes, and then we believe, ah, oh, I am trapped again. It's not the condition that harms us. It's again, as Tamisara pointed out in her talk, it's our relationship to it. Even after the Buddha's awakening, he's free. For 7 years after the Buddha's awakening, Mara followed him around. Mara, the embodiment in the Buddhist teachings of the tempter, of that which confuses us. In the Old Testament, it's like in the book of Job, it's called the Hasatan, that force of causing us to doubt. Still follow the Buddha around and whispered things like, you're not really enlightened, you know. Why are you all alone in a forest? You should be out there enjoying yourself. Why are you going through all this difficulty? You would tell him different things like that. And the Buddha would, when these different doubts and things appeared in the Buddha's mind, if he would have thought, oh God, I thought I was finished with doubt. Gee, I'm not the Buddha. I've even spoken a lie. I proclaimed it. Oh dear. Well, he said, I know you. I know you. He recognized it. Mara came and went. Some of our tendencies, we're waiting around for peacefulness just when there's no more worry, no more doubt, no more this, no more that. We'll be waiting until the cows come home. Long time. Or we can start fooling ourselves. Start convincing ourselves that we're attained. Convincing ourselves that we don't have these emotions. Convincing ourselves that we're like that Buddha image on the wall, sitting there just perfectly immovable. Might be the case, but it can happen. We can just convince ourselves and blind ourselves, pushing things away. But to let things be as they are, they come and go. If we pick them up and own them, then we got the problems. As our teacher said, Ajahn Chah, in his earthy wisdom, and his disciples would be with him, he'd point to a big boulder, a big stone, and say, is that heavy? They say, yes, Lumpa, that's heavy. I couldn't lift it up. And Lumpa, which means Venerable Father, Lumpa would say, is that heavy? He said, it's only heavy if you try to lift it. If you try to push it, if you try to shift it. If you're not pushing it and trying to lift it, is it heavy? It is just what it is. When doubts come, worries come, fears come, do we lift them? Do we push them? Oh gosh, it's in the mind. That tendency to own it, be so heavy with it. When we tack on to our experience, that sense of ownership, things get heavy. When we let them be, then we patiently let them run their course. It's a very beautiful teaching, patience. Learning to be at ease just with what is, not just waiting for it to finish. That's not patience. That's impatience. Well, I'll be patient with you. I've been patient with you for 5 minutes now, 10 minutes, a whole week. Tapping my foot, that's still not the perfection of patience. Patience gets deeper when we learn to relax with. Also on this evening, the Buddha gave a simple teaching, overviewing the whole path. Sarva papasa karanam kusala supasampada sajitta pariyoda panayetam buddhana sasanam. Sarva papasa karanam, all that is harmful, all that is evil, akaranam, not to do it. Kusala supasampada, that which is good, lifting that up, making much of it, cultivating the good. Sajitta pariyotapanam, citta, heart, sajitta, this heart, my heart, your heart. Pariyotapanam, purifying the heart. Etam buddhana sasanam, thus, there it is, this is the teaching of all the Buddhas, not just this Buddha, but through all time, in all eternity. This is the teaching of the awakened ones. To reflect on what is harmful. Those impulses to harm others. Thinking that we find peace just by destroying. That harms others, it harms ourselves. Because it makes us imagine that peace comes from getting the conditions perfectly. Yes, we know we can't get them perfectly. As soon as we have them over here, perfectly, and the fly starts buzzing, and we get our spray out and spray the fly, then the machine starts over there, then we rush out and cut the gas line on his machine, then our shoulder starts hurting. This world, you can't get it perfect. Always something shifting and changing. Aversion, the idea that we get peace by just getting rid of what we don't want, might give us some kind of peace, but it's not real peace. Deep peace is found in the heart that realizes that things come and things go. That we can't find stability in just making things perfect, because it is the nature of things to become otherwise. So these tendencies that harm ourselves in the great religious traditions, they all agree pretty much. It's learning to refrain from intentional harming, refraining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, use of speech to lie, and speech just for harshness's sake, speech that divides people rather than helps unite people, speech that's just meaningless. All the great religious traditions agree this sort of activity obstructs us. Also, learning to treasure our consciousness, our ability to be clear. Noticing the tendency to seek nibbana through intoxication, just to feel good by just getting drunk or stoned. It feels good, but it doesn't solve the problem. And also we then can harm our instrument for seeing clearly, our instrument for being careful. So learning to in our times of stopping, our times of Shabbat, to sense in this pausing, is there anything that I've said or done that is harming myself or harming others? And to feel remorse is useful. It's helpful. It's helpful when we feel the pain of having harmed someone. Not to then hate ourselves and think, I'm just this terrible, terrible sinner. But there's an English word, remorse, that means it's a natural conscience that helps us recognize when we've done something that's not in harmony with the way, with truth. Then we learn from that, because then we can resolve that, oh, that will teach me how to be different next time. Then that remorse, that mistake, will turn into something that we learn from, and then redirect our sight in the right, a proper, a skillful direction. That's the skillful guilt, just to keep hating ourselves. I'm no good. That's not skillful and helpful. But remorse or conscience, that which helps us learn from our mistakes so that we can go in a good direction, that's considered very skillful. Our Shabbat days, our pausing days, our retreat days are useful for helping us learn from our mistakes. In helping us kusala supasampada, lifting up that which is useful. On these 5 days and nights together, I hope we have some sense of what is useful. Is listening useful? Listening to our body, sensing if it's tired, if it's tense. Listening, and then appreciating what blesses us. Like the simple in-breath, that gift that's freely given, that we're allowed to breathe in. We can take a deep breath and no one will look at us like you're being greedy. We can take a deep in-breath and a slow out-breath. Skillful to remember simple things. The beauty of lighting a candle. The beauty of listening. The beauty of stopping after 6 days of work, noticing the sunset. Remembering our family, remembering the sacred, listening, awareness, that which everything returns to. Hopefully in these 5 days or so, we can, each of us, have things that we now know help me. So we cultivate that. We make much of it, whether it's listening, being with the body, Qigong, learning to direct our attention to this present moment, learning to be patient, learning to investigate and see the changing nature of things, learning how to let go, learning how to embrace, to uplift the good in sajitta pariyota panang, to purify the heart from these things which cloud us from really appreciating the beauty. When our heart is confused, imagining that we find security in grasping, in owning my body, my feelings, my success, my problems, then this world becomes dukkha. We might have pleasant things that we get hold of, but they keep changing and we struggle. When the heart in moments is purified of greed, hatred, and delusion, in moments, when there's clear seeing that what arises ceases, that these sensations and thoughts are like bubbles, when we appreciate that and realize the strain of trying to look for security in something that's beauty is in being ephemeral, impermanent. When we see that and have that letting go, that relaxing relief, we know that we can't ultimately grab hold of things. We give ourselves permission to rest and then feel the ground, the ocean of presence, where all thoughts and all feelings merge, where everything comes together, where we're not trying to lift that stone, where we can just let things be. in our pausing, we can remember the sacred. What is truly sacred? The Buddha had a disciple that would gaze at him all the time, because the Buddha was had a beautiful complexion, lovely voice. I suppose his manner was very peaceful to watch. His disciple just gazed at the Buddha all the time. He had faith. It's not a bad thing. But the Buddha then started to consider he's missing the point. So the Buddha sent him to a remote place to practice. Sent him to practice in a forest away from him. And this fellow then felt despairing. I've been sent away from the Buddha. He sent me away. I'm separate from the Buddha. And the Buddha read his mind. The Buddha could sense his thoughts. And the Buddha appeared to him and said, Why are you despairing? And he said, you sent me away. And the Buddha pointed to his body. The Buddha pointed to his own body and said, you think this is the Buddha? This body? Okay, you call me the awakened one. You can call me the Buddha. But this isn't the real Buddha. This body goes back to the earth. As does your body, everyone else's body. The Buddha then said to this disciple, he or the person who sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. When you see things the way they are, when we see what arises ceases, that all our opinions about ourselves and others, all our thoughts are just what they are. They're like bubbles. They're there, they're gone. When we see the Dharma, the nature of things, that all conditioned dharmas are changing, and that in not grasping at them, we recognize the underlying stillness, that which never dies, that which is peaceful, that which, where everything merges, everything comes together. The one that sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. There is nothing that's apart from the Buddha. There's nothing that totally defines the Buddha. So wherever you point, to your own body, to the mountaintop, that's not apart from the Buddha. But you can't limit the Buddha. You can't say the Buddha's locked inside that body from 2,500 years ago. We call that the Buddha, but that's the conventional Buddha. That's not the timeless Buddha. That's not the Buddha we take refuge in. The Buddha we take refuge in is that which sees the Dharma. It's that true, ever-present, listening, knowing, core that right now listens to these sounds, that right now knows your body, that right now is reflecting on your thoughts. In this sacred space, we might meet it on retreat. We might remember it at Shabbat time. But remember that in every place where we are, this sacred essence, this Dharma, is always here and now. and it includes everything. As I began 5 days ago and said, everything is here. I'm here because my mother and father. I'm here because in the last hours of my mother's life, she wanted me to, and Tanisra still, to be able to come here. I'm here because my father made it very clear to me he would be unhappy if I dropped everything, rushed back there. Even though he was suffering, missing Mom after 62 years together, it made him happy to know that Tanisra and I were still going to come here to Israel. So the sacredness of this moment is not apart from my father. It's not apart from that I can breathe. It's not apart from how touched Tanisra and myself have been to be with you all these 5 days and nights, sharing this space, sharing these sounds, sharing your experiences, sensing people's sincerity, sharing in your sufferings and your joys, your obstacles and your breakthroughs. Even the difficult things that happen to us are part of the sacred perfection of things. I remember 37 years ago, when I used to be stronger and I was a wrestling champion, 5-time Mid-South wrestling champion, national wrestling champion, captain of our wrestling team with another young man. We were 2 captains of our team, of a southern team in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And we had a match with another school across town. And I came from a part of the world which was famous for some of its racial problems. The southern part of the states at that time had some racial problems, tensions between the black people and the white people. I went to a military school that only had white people in it. And we were going to wrestle a school across town that had some black people in it. And the captain of their team was going to wrestle me. And he was a black person. And in my town, wrestling was really intense, and thousands of people would come out and scream, and it was very intense. He sent a message across town. I probably shouldn't say exactly what he said. But he sent a message, something to the effect is, I'm going to kick your butt. Which is the kind of way you talked in those days. And so I thought, and so in wrestling, you start from the little weights. They finish in the next weight, then the next weight, the next weight. So on a team, you have little ones, bigger ones, bigger ones, bigger ones, and at last, the big heavyweights wrestle. I was pretty light. I was about at that time, I think I wrestled in the 126-pound class. So I was about match number, 2 or 3. And so we got out on there's a referee, and there's a big match. And the referee says, shake hands, have a good match. Blows the whistle, woo-hoo! And then you start. And I was wrestling a young man named Jerome. And he came to me, hit me in the head. And this wasn't boxing, it's wrestling. And so the referee stopped the match, everyone starts screaming. He said, you're not supposed to hit people. And so so that woke me up. And so then we started wrestling. And he was stronger than me. But he lunged for me, and he made a mistake. He left his elbow out, which allowed me to do a very spectacular move. Big crowd pleaser move. I could do a thing where you flip him. It's called a lateral drop. It's a real fancy. It looks fancy, but it's because he left his elbow out. And so in a second, I had him on his back. That means I got 2 points for taking him down. And since he was on his back, I get 3 more points. So suddenly I'm ahead 5-0. I'm thinking, oh, that's wonderful. And so then I'm resting, because he's trying to get off of his back. And the crowd's going wild, screaming and everything. And then I feel this piercing pain. And I'm thinking, he's biting me. And so then I thought, God, I've got to do something about this. So then I had what's called a half Nelson on him. And so then I just did it tighter. And then finally, if you keep someone's shoulder blades on the mat long enough, the referee slaps the mat and it's finished. And then my team gets 5 points because that's a big win. And so, but I jumped up, and I was still hurting, so I ripped my uniform up, and there were these teeth marks and blood coming out. And I said, he bit me! and then all hell breaks loose. Because then he says, let's fight! And I'm a wrestler, but not a fighter. And then a big wave of people from their grandstand started to come off to fight. I have a giant for a coach. He's huge. My coach. You know Coach?
Yeah.
My coach comes running out and puts his hand on my head and booms out, anybody touches this boy and I'm going to start swinging. So, you know, we had this like almost a riot situation. And then they rushed me back and tried to treat my wounds. And I said to my coach, I said, I need to talk to that guy. He wants to kill me. And my coach said, no. I said, no. I really want to talk to him. And because I don't like having an enemy. And so I finally, meanwhile, the next matches were going on and there's a lot of tension. I was worried we might have a riot. And so I got permission from my coach and then I walked to their side of the gym, kind of tense. And I went to see him, and I can't remember exactly what I said, but I said something like, how you doing? And he said, something like that. And I said, well, I don't like to be pinned. And I said, well, I don't like to be bitten. And I said, you know, I was very lucky. I said, because, you know, do you know what you did? You left your elbow out. I said, you want me to show you? You left your elbow out, and that's why I was lucky. Because with your elbow out, I was able to do this lateral drop. And so I showed him the move. And then we got to talking. And you know, why am I saying this? Okay. I haven't gone crazy yet. You are allowed to tell stories on Shabbat, aren't you? Okay. Years later, when I was at Princeton University, and the university said, why don't you apply? They sent me a letter and said, why don't you apply for a Rhodes Scholarship and to Oxford? And I hadn't even thought about it. And I said, oh, okay. But to do it, you have to get recommendations from different teachers. So I had to ask some old teachers to write who I was. And one teacher who had been there that day wrote about that, about seeing this tense situation. And I went over and talked to this young man, and it helped calm it down. And then when the interviews came for the Rhodes Scholarship, even though I'd gotten off to a real bad start, I won't go into that because we could be here all night, but I'd gotten off to a bad start. I offended one of the people on the committee, one of the big judges. I just made an innocent comment. It was during the Watergate era, and President Nixon was in trouble, and I thought there were so many lawyers that were involved, and I thought, don't lawyers learn about telling the truth? And that wasn't a very nice thing to say, because this guy was head of the Bar Association in Florida, and he took it personally, and it was very unskillful of me, so I just thought, I'm finished. But anyway, he had written this, somebody had written this in, and that's what they wanted to hear, and so I got to tell the story. And so then I got the scholarship. I went to Oxford, and then at Oxford, I was able to get miserable enough that I heard about Ajahn Chah in Thailand, that I was able to become a monk, and because I was able to become a monk, I was eventually able to meet the Buddha's teaching and practice, and to meet special people alive, like Tanisara, able to come to special places like Israel. And you know what? If it wasn't for Jerome White biting me, that wouldn't have happened. I'm not joking. You think he bit me. And yet, how perfect. What a gift he gave me. He gave me the opportunity to try to respond and to do something. And I haven't seen him all these years later, but wherever Jerome White is, I mean it, sincerely, your biting me was a gift from God. And so, in our Shabbat, when we stop and consider and really pause, we're here because the whole world is just as it is, and that blessings, not only are beautiful blessings, but even those difficult things in our life are part of the perfection. Are you skeptical, Tanisha?
I wonder where you're going
for
that.
So this life is a mystery. It really is a mystery. Things that you think are going way wrong, just wait a minute. Wait a minute. You don't know. Just pause. In these times of pausing, on retreat, on Shabbat, during the day, just pausing, listening, being patient, looking freshly again at this moment. Very, very, very important. Very important. We do indeed have many blessings. And I do feel we all are very, very fortunate to have the time in our life, the interest to be able to come to a place like this, to pause, to review our life, that we've had the chance to meet the wisdom teachings of the Buddha, that we've had the interest in the faith that not only can we hear it, but we can practice it, and that it is our destiny, according to the Buddha. The fact that we've done this, we need to be patient, but that we've done this, little by little by little by little, we will, like a flower, open and wake up to our true nature, because that is the truth. Our true nature is luminous. Our true nature is peaceful. We have the potentiality within our heart for profound wisdom. for boundless compassion. This is within us. This is something we can access. So I'd like to finish this evening by reading a quote from our dear teacher, Ajahn Chah. About this path, about what all of us, if we're patient, stay with it, little by little, this is what we'll meet. We will reach a point where the heart tells itself what to do. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful rare animals will come to drink at the pool. And you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go. But you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go. That you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. Our true Dharma body. Is linked with all things. All places. Our true nature is vast. Not apart from anyone. With a joyful heart, may we share the many blessings of our lives, above, below, and all around. For the welfare of all beings, feeling the ease of letting go, like dropping a pebble into a still pool, letting the ripples move to the farther shores. With each out-breath, may we share the goodness of our life with loved ones, those we know, those we don't know, even those who we struggle with. May all beings be at ease.
Amen.